Hi, guys. Thank you for your continued support of the Paleo Solution Podcast. I also wanted to take a moment and thank two of our wonderful podcast sponsors. The first is Thrive Market. Thrive is a new online marketplace offering the world's best-selling natural and organic products at wholesale prices. If Costco and Whole Foods Online got together at a rave and got liquored up, their child would look a lot like Thrive Market. So the way that Thrive works, for less than $5 a month, about $59.95 annually, you get a membership that gives you access to more than 2,500 of the highest quality food, supplement, home, personal care, and beauty products. Those are all delivered straight to your door and at 25 to 50% below retail price. Orders above $49 are free, but that's only in the continental United States. RobWolf.com followers get a free two-month Thrive Market membership, as well as 20% off of your first order. So go to thrivemarket.com/Rob Wolf, and you can get in on that deal. Our second podcast sponsor is Hylete. Check out Hylete's innovative athletic apparel at Hylete.com. If you love Hylete, and I absolutely do, you can love a whole lot more of them, because if you enter the code ROBWOLF50, ROBBWOLF50, you receive a holy cat's worthy 50% off your purchase. Thank you again, and it's time for the show. Hi, folks. Rob Wolf here, another edition of the Paleo Solution Podcast. Very excited today for our guest, Chris Martinson. Chris has a PhD in neurotoxicology and has stepped out of that specific scientific discipline and started looking many years ago at the intersecting concepts of energy, the economy, and the environment. And from my earliest days in this kind of paleo evolutionary medicine scene, I had some inklings that we would need to address these issues as our planet grows, as we as a culture develop. And in the past maybe 4 or 5 years, Chris's Peak Prosperity website has been an incredible resource for myself and my family, really helping me to understand how these interrelated concepts go together. And it has given me a really profound sense of calm amidst the changes that we're all facing. So, Chris, thank you and welcome for coming on the show.
Rob, it's a real pleasure to be here.
Well, Chris, that was a paltry introduction, really, given your bona fides. Could you give folks more of your background? And, you know, mixed into that, I've got to ask this question because I'm often thrown this question. What does a scientist in neuroscience, you know, from a neuroscience background, what possible insight could you have on energy, the economy, and the environment? So maybe weaving that into the story as well, you know, with a little bit of your extended bio.
Sure, be happy to. You know, I did start my life as a scientist, got a lot of training, and did a PhD and a postdoc, both at Duke University. And there is no department of neurotoxicology, so that's a subspecialty. So my degree is actually through the Department of Pathology. So I had to do all the usual pathology things, and you know, just to connect it all the way through, what I'm doing right now really is just what scientists do when you look at the world. You develop a hypothesis, you gather a bunch of data. But what a pathologist can add to this is the concept of doing a postmortem. And, you know, I'm really examining the clues for what's going on in the world. So my science side of my life was all about gathering data and really being wedded to what the data was telling me and being very careful to allow myself to reject a hypothesis, no matter how much I loved it or favored it, if the data didn't support it. So that was good training. And then a little bit later, I took a hard turn to the right, went and got an MBA, and went and worked a number of years, about 10 years in corporate America, and finished up as vice president of SAIC, a very large company that does private and government contracting. I was on the private side. But on that side, I was doing a lot of strategy consulting, getting a lot of familiarity with numbers and building and understanding the importance of stories. Business is really a bunch of stories, you know. Even the CFO has to tell a story. So I really got good at figuring out how to problem solve and using my science background for data, and then this ability to begin to put complex pieces together to tell stories. And I discovered I'm actually a pretty good translator. And one thing led to another, and starting about 2001 and 2002, I became very concerned about the way the world was going. Of course, my personal portfolio was getting shredded in the rundown of the stock market after the 2000 peak, getting very, let's say, incomplete, inconclusive, and unsatisfying answers from my broker as to what to do. I started looking into the economy, got scared right away, just simple things, unfunded entitlements, and you know the unsustainability of the economy was right there to find easily for somebody who was curious. And that was frightening enough, but when I started to look at what the economy really is and how it's funded by energy, and that in fact the economy is a subset of the natural world, not the other way around, and weaving the environment in. It took, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years for this story that became the crash course to come together. And I was telling it to audiences in the basements of churches and at local community colleges, just very locally, mostly because I just wanted to find other people who shared my point of view, because I thought there were things we needed to do to get ready. Eventually, I ran into somebody who said, hey, this really needs to be on the internet. And so one thing led to another, and the crash course became a video series online. And much to my surprise, Rob, it was successful, because it's a total disaster. I mean, come on. It's some guy.
It's a buzzkill. It's
a buzzkill, and it's some disembodied voice speaking over charts for 3.5 hours. It's a complete disaster, right? But it caught people because it was truth, and it had both explanatory and a little bit of predictive power, and it got translated into a bunch of languages, and people resonated with it. And that's where I first discovered that people are hungry for high quality information that's true.
Chris, I got into this kind of evolutionary medicine stuff from a personal health crisis, started tinkering and fiddling, and then this idea of, an ancestral diet, paleo diet, sleep, food, exercise, gut biome, socialization being quite different today versus the period of time that formed most of our species history, that there might be some discordance there, and that might be a place to look for problems. And so for me, looking at health and fitness and now kind of heading into medical risk assessment, I've used the fundamentals of ecology and evolutionary biology to kind of orient my questions. Those things really don't give specific answers, but it really is a great spot to start an orientation with questions. How did you... it's kind of a leading question. I think I kind of know the answer here, but where are you at with this idea of fundamentals when you are looking at things, to start from a big picture heuristic that people can wrap their arms around and have some sort of an idea, and then auger in and start asking specific questions that are maybe testable, or at least we can look at previous data sets and whatnot to be able to find some answers?
Yeah, great question. There's two pieces to that for me. The first is that the more I learn about how the world actually works, I mean, what we're learning about DNA at this point in time and how it actually is not as static as I thought. Because I was raised, when I went to college and learned molecular biology, DNA was like reading a book. There's some base pairs, and you've got your codes and you've got your codons, and you just string them out and it makes a protein, and we can fiddle with this to our heart's content. And now we know that actually the DNA is in communication with the world around it and to a very high degree. And so what I get from that, first of all, is this idea of humility, which is that as much as we think we know, it's important to hold open the idea that we still don't know very much yet. And where that comes around is for me is in this idea, second of all, of looking at how we have to really trust that the data that we do have, how can we really interpret it? So epidemiologically, let's just buy the numbers. Let's look where we are today in America. Let's say we're from, we're some alien species. We're going to come down and America has an existential crisis and says, look, we have an opportunity to either build this culture exactly as it's already built, or we can do something different. Would we rebuild it? And the aliens hopefully would go by the numbers and say, well, I'm looking at your levels of obesity, and I'm looking at the numbers of sleep disorders and autoimmune conditions, and I'm looking at levels of violence that exist and the number of children that are on psychoactive drugs, and on and on and on. And you could go across all of these markers of epidemiological markers of health and say, this isn't really healthy. Our advice would be you wouldn't probably want to rebuild it exactly like you got it. Something is off here, right? Just off. And then it takes a lot of work, as you know, to begin to start to unravel that and say, well, why is it off? How is it off this badly? And so to me, the idea of returning to zero and saying, look, let's pretend this last 200 years has been a little nutty. Let's go back to the to this idea that human DNA is actually billions of years old, but in our current species form, it's a couple hundred thousand years old. But still, there's a lot of evolutionary pressures and selection and intelligence built into our DNA blueprint as it exists. And if something's off in the story, it's probably we're trying to cram our DNA blueprint into the wrong operating model, as it were. You know, we're giving it instructions that it wasn't really designed to handle, and so you get these crazy things on the out, you know, on the output side.
Chris, given some of the let's take that story and let's assume it's true. Some folks will argue with that kind of evolutionary biology story, but let's assume that that's true. A lot of what I take from that is that living in small hunter-gatherer groups, opportunistic omnivores, we had a lot of latitude with where we could go, what we could do. If we depleted resources in one area, we could move to another. We tended to deal with problems on a pretty short-term basis. How do we take the wiring that has made us so successful in that scene but seems to be not working so well with tackling issues that maybe, you know, 50 or 100 years down the road and, you know, occur on a global level where the numbers are incomprehensible to our minds? How do we, you know, kind of educate ourselves, educate the people around us about that stuff? And then also, how do we make that the least bit sexy or interesting? Like I keep having this quip that, sustainability should be more interesting than getting abs, but it's not. Like, you know, if you just do a dummy Twitter account and put a good looking gal or guy with, you know, virtually no clothes on and they're pretty lean and jacked, just a dummy account will probably end up getting 10 or 15,000 followers in pretty short order, you know, which is reasonably impressive. But if you try to say something substantive, becomes pretty contentious, not much interest. I mean, how have you been able to navigate sharing these complex stories and get some traction in this world?
That's a very good question. And it turned, for me, the turning point was understanding that I'm not in the business of sharing information. Hmm. If I was, it would be as simple as sharing the information and then people would change. And I'm a scientist and a business guy. So information has that capability in my life. And I have this horrible problem where I think people are built like me. So I put all this information out and it didn't work. Right. And so that was my first learning. And then I started to understand that when people were actually beginning to digest what I was really telling them, they weren't going through a mental reorientation process. They were going through an emotional reorientation process. And that's where I first understood that, oh, it's not the information, that what really is happening here, it's belief challenging material. And when people's beliefs are challenged, it has a very predictable process. First, there's tremendous resistance to having the beliefs challenged at all. And I bet evolutionarily that makes total sense, right? Like it takes a lot of time to develop a new framework or schema. So you have a lot invested in it. Just keep running it. That probably made sense, right? So A, you resist. But then B, once those resistances finally get broken down, you know, somebody has a heart attack or their bank account gets wiped out and finally they go, oh, I have to rethink this, right? That's an intensely emotional process, and they go through the usual pieces of coming out of that denial and into the anger and depression and the bargain and all of those usual stages. And so understanding that this was – that what I was doing was really in a process of trying to give people belief-orienting and challenging and maybe even reforming information – I had to be very cognizant of the fact of what I was actually asking them to do, which is a big deal. It's a big deal to ask somebody to enter into emotionally turbulent territory. And so once I understood that, one of the first things I had to do was strip out all of my belief-oriented material that I could identify, and I'm sure there's more in there, but taking my own beliefs out of it as much as possible. So that there was a little bit of a blank slate characteristic to this information. To me, that was a critical moment of insight, a critical moment of understanding how to go about talking to people about this. Because if people knew that I was a Democrat or a Republican or a Libertarian, automatically the people who aren't those things would go, oh, he's got the wrong – I can just tune this guy out right away. That's like, oh, thank you for the exit door right near me. I just can just leave you behind right now. But all there's a lot of other beliefs that exists out there. Now, I'm not talking religious beliefs, although that's a big piece that we left out. But there's beliefs around things like faith and authority, faith in technology, belief in the American dream. There's a lot of things that I had to understand the mental, emotional minefield that I was navigating and strip all that stuff out. And then that really enabled me to have more effect because I'm approaching people less from a proselytizing, energized, you have to listen to me, the world is coming to an end point, but I can say, look, here's some data that I would like to share with you. It's very important. I understand it's difficult, and wherever you are with it is totally fine, including if you want to be nowhere with it. So that relaxing and allowing it being not just intellectually, but I mean fully emotionally comfortable with wherever somebody is exactly where they need to be. And so not trying to push them off of whatever stance they're in into some new stance, that made me a lot more effective than in the old days when I would try and grab them by the lapels and say, no, you don't, I don't think you understand.
Well, you know, it's funny. I had a very similar process for myself. And I guess maybe it is whether, you know, certain personalities or mental types kind of head into science, or maybe it's the process of going through science. Usually once you add the data, then the implications were pretty straightforward and you just learned to divorce emotionality from that whole process. And most of the rest of the world probably thankfully doesn't operate that way. So, you know, the technicians, I guess, like us need to learn a different way of approaching that. I'm curious, one thing, or there's this kind of piece to this story that I still waffle back and forth on. And I think you could probably argue with it. Both you and I probably orient things a little bit from an Austrian economics kind of perspective and markets being these really fantastic signaling mechanisms and whatnot. And a lot of the people that come out of that genre might be in kind of the Matt Ridley rational optimist kind of camp that, you know, technology is going to pull our fannies out of the flame. Life has gotten better and easier for everybody. And I don't think that we can really argue with that. But I think that there's an inflection point to that. And I think that that's some of the things that you've talked about that, you know, and this kind of goes back to the fundamentals again, energy, the economy, and the environment. All of that story, I think, arguably is pretty true. But will it always be true given resource allocations and whatnot? What do you think about that? Because I've got to be honest, I feel schizophrenic on that topic. Like I'll read a Matt Ridley book or listen to some of his podcasts, listen to some of his talks, and I'm kind of like, okay, well, maybe thorium will pull us all together. Maybe there's some energetic medium that's going to come in and set the ship right. Technology has been improving things for us for the last 200 or 300 years. Is there an inflection point with that? Are we just two chicken littles, you know, screaming into the ether, and we're going to end up being proven wrong on all this stuff? Or what are your thoughts on all that?
Great question. The answer is nobody knows. And so to me, the most rational stance you can take is to note the trends of things and just guess that if the trends don't change, they'll probably keep going in the same direction. It's kind of like if you looked at somebody and they said, well, I was 180 pounds in college, and within 5 years I was 250, and now I'm 350. You can sort of extrapolate that and say, well, it's always possible you'll have a miraculous recovery, but otherwise I'm kind of going to guess where you're headed with this story. And so there is a lot that technology is doing for us, but often left out of that is the other side, which is, well, what is it not doing for us? And technology is a two-edged sword, and we have to recognize that, right? People usually don't, but I think it's important, right? So we see this now we have actually in America one of the most raging heroin epidemics that we've had in a long time. I mean, somehow, thankfully, the Taliban were convinced to continue growing poppies again, and so the world's flooded with cheap heroin. And the reason we have a heroin epidemic, I'm convinced, is because people are so disconnected from each other. And that it's really been proven that the reason people have addictions is because they are disconnected from self, they're disconnected from nature, and they're disconnected from other. And so, yes, I love my smartphone, and it allows me to feel hyper-connected, but the truth is it doesn't actually connect me human to human. And so if I'm not careful about that, and if I don't balance my use of technology knowingly and consciously, saying it does all these wonderful things for me, but it's a lie to say that my phone makes me more connected than anybody's ever been connected before. It's not true. What connects me is when I have real experiences with real people involving touch, eye contact, speech communication, and we do real things together. And my phone can help set all that up because we can get together more easily and all of that. But it would be a mistake to think that technology alone has made us more connected. Because in fact, the data says it probably hasn't. When we look at things like addictions, mental illnesses, other things that are really signs of that disconnection. And in truth, the most vile form of torture that humans have ever discovered is prolonged solitary confinement.
Right, right.
And so in some ways, we've created little solitary cells for ourselves through our so-called connecting technologies. And so I am, on one hand, I am schizophrenic. I'm hopeful that we will develop some technologies. But if we do not develop the necessary cultural stories and narratives to use those technologies well, we'll destroy ourselves with them. So I'm in Maine at the moment, and I've been coming up here for 30 years, and the oceans are absolutely sterile compared to what they used to be 30 years ago. There's no urchins because they started harvesting them all because Asian people like to eat them. And next thing you know, they over-harvested the urchins, which used to be so common you had to watch where you were walking. You would step on them. Now you can't even find them. The flatfish are all gone. There's no herring runs here anymore. The crabs pretty well got wiped out. Lobsters are doing okay, but mostly because they farm them here, meaning that, you know, they throw them all back and catch bait fish. The Gulf shrimp just collapsed this year. They had to close the harvest down for the first time. And a lot of that, Rob, comes because we have this marvelous thing called GPS. Mm-hmm. It's a simple technology. Like, how could GPS be harmful? Well, it's harmful because the trawlers who leave from Bedford, they go out and they literally drop their nets 6 inches away from where they stopped last week, you know, 30 miles out in the ocean, and there's nowhere for the fish to hide anymore because we're just so good. And so if we had GPS plus the cultural narrative and framework for how you would use that technology and not destroy the oceans at the same time, I think it could be a good thing. But all the evidence so far says technology alone, without the cultural understanding, without the awareness of the pros and the cons, without really integrating that into a larger fabric, has more often than not turned out to be a mistake, not an enhancement.
I couldn't agree more. I forget where the concept of the Nash equilibrium kind of got onto my radar a couple of years mm-hmm. ago, and John Nash, a famous mathematician, you know, the basic takeaway from the Nash equilibrium is in a game theory scenario, if everybody in the game is kind of following certain rules, everybody will maximally benefit. And I correct me if I'm wrong, but I think what you're saying is that if we properly applied like this GPS technology, let's say we could minimize the amount of energy expenditure that we go out to harvest fish or crabs or what, you know, whatever the thing is that we're going after. But if we used a little bit of forethought about, okay, well, we need to leave this much of the population there and maybe not fish this area for 3 years just preemptively so that we can have a bloom on these fisheries, then there might be some sort of enhanced return both in minimizing energy input but then maximizing the outputs. But instead of doing that, humans, because we're so good at technological advancement, and because we've always come from a place of plenty in general, particularly as technology has advanced, we're not really thinking about that endpoint that if we overplay our hand in this game, we may end up very short shrift in the future.
Absolutely. And, you know, when it comes to the fisheries that I was just talking about, for instance, but this could apply to anywhere. We think we know what we're doing because we have biologists and they go out and they do their measurement nets and they discover how many Gulf shrimp there are. And so they look at the total tonnage that's available. They look at the harvest schedules. They set quotas and people go out and take stuff. It sounds managed, but what's missing from that is not just about the Gulf shrimp. They're in a dynamic equilibrium, as Nash was talking about, that whole idea of a suboptimal equilibrium that he got the Nobel Prize for. You know, that's an idea that everything's in flux, and then there becomes an equilibrium point amongst all the actors. So just measuring the shrimp, you got a good measure on how many shrimp there are, but you're failing to notice what's happening with the number of ground fish that are happening at the same time and the migratory patterns, and there's this other spike that happens with the cod. And, oh, by the way, there's algal blooms that go in different sequences, which then influence the zooplankton, which it's all very complex. And so what we would have, I think, if we were more intelligent at this point, more sophisticated, is an understanding that we don't know everything yet. And so instead of saying we could take this many shrimp, we might go, this many minus a big buffer, because we still don't quite know what the heck's going on out there. There are interactions that we don't get yet. And that humility of saying we don't quite know this yet, I think would be very important to have. And I mean, I'm just noticing recently, and I'm sure you know tons more about this than I do, but just the explosion of understanding around the fact that the 100 trillion cells that are not ours, that are in and on our bodies, are actually really important to how they function, that somehow our gut bacteria actually have an important role to play. And just seeing how that's sort of dawning, it's an of course moment, but I bet you it's going to be decades before we really appreciate what's going on in there. And even then, we might want to have a little humility that there's more happening here that we haven't quite understood yet.
Absolutely. I you know, this idea of intestinal permeability being a legit pathological condition, if you were to look at this back around 2003, 2004 in PubMed, you might find 300 or 400 citations, most of them saying that this idea of intestinal permeability or gut dysbiosis was quackery. And today, if you put intestinal permeability into PubMed, I think it's almost 14,000 citations. It's just one of the hottest areas of immunological research, and it is absolutely in its infancy. Like I thought I knew something 10 years ago, and now I feel like I get dumber every day. So, you know, that point is really well taken. It's something that I guess makes me a little nervous on this, and again, this may be a little bit of a leading question, but is any degree of attempted management going to fail about the way that we're seeing attempts at managing the economy and fractional reserve banking and all those shenanigans? I mean, because these systems are so incredibly complex, I mean, is that just the way that we need to do it? Just provide as massive a buffer as tolerable and then let those systems operate to their best efficiency?
Yes. The answer is yes, because complex systems by their nature are inherently unpredictable. Even things we study like intensely, like a single fault, like how hard could it be to understand a fault? We can measure plate slippage. We can measure the degree to which the pressures are building. We know that stochastically, like how often this thing is supposed to release and with what intensity. With all of that, we have no clue when the next earthquake is going to come or how big it's going to be. And that's because even something seemingly as studyable as a fault, which is just two locked plates of rock that are trying to get past each other and do it in a jerky way, it's a complex system and it's almost impossible to predict. So what we can do, though, is we can have that humility again to say, you know, like with the Federal Reserve saying, oh, we'll just run interest rates to zero. And what's going to happen is the economy is going to take off, the banking system will get healthy, and people will get jobs. Not understanding that there's this complex dynamic between an interest rate is a fairly, you know, dry sort of a concept, but what's a really live and dynamic concept is how people interact with interest rates. And that's something that the Fed has nobody on staff, nobody anywhere, who has any clue about sociology, about that sorts of history. They only look at their little monetary equations. They think they can drive the monetary ship by tweaking their equations a little bit and doing certain things without an understanding that it has a very, very large impact. And it goes well beyond just simple economics, Rob. You know, so the amount of shale oil that people decided to just try and rip out of the ground in all the shale plays, principally in the Bakken play in North Dakota and the Eagle Ford down in Texas, was actually a function of the fact that when money goes to zero and they could borrow really cheaply, then the dynamic of oil investigation and taking out of the ground changed radically. And all of a sudden people were doing things that a few years ago they never would have done. And so you see there somebody decided to set interest rates at zero to help banking and get unemployment, but all of a sudden they led to this massive burst of capital that ended up creating malinvestments, a lot of environmental destruction, and ended up upsetting the world oil markets. And by the time they try and figure out how they're going to manage that, there will be a new crisis somewhere else. And instead, what we need to understand, this is everything that my work centers around, is that the economy itself is a subset of the natural world. Energy is a subset of even that. So if, you know, you can have all the money in the world, Rob, but if you wreck your soils, you know, they all get degraded and or leached out to the Gulf of Mexico. And when you've taken all your high grade energy and burned that, and now you're down to the lower grades, but you pretend it doesn't matter because, you know, you've made money so cheap that the price of oil seems cheap. without understanding that we're humans, we're organisms, we are no different than any other animal out there, we will grow into the availability of the resources that exist around us. And that's always been true. And I don't see anything in that trajectory, you know, no matter what technology comes along. Technology does a lot of things, but it will never and has not yet created energy. It transforms it. It helps us find it, use it more efficiently, but it doesn't create it. So as I look into the world of energy, I can look at my youngest daughter, who's 15, and if she's born in the year 2000. So if she lives to the same age as my grandfather, she dies in the year 2096. So what happens by 2096? Well, let's be clear about this. We're way past the peak of oil. We're way past the peak of coal, natural gas, soil, probably phosphorus, all these things that are just critical to maintaining a large, vibrant, robust economy. And so that's that's where people can look at it and go, oh, that's kind of a dire forecast. The opportunity in this is to look around you. Everybody listening to this right now, we live in one of the most extraordinary times in human history. We are surrounded by so much energy. You can live like a god, right? A king? Nope, more than that, a god. Because right. A king 200 years ago couldn't pick up the phone and decide to be in Australia tomorrow. I can do that, right? That's more godlike than kinglike. And we have all these energy slaves. And so the opportunity in that is that people can use this time in the ease of living now to become anything they want to be, do anything they want to do. And that's what I love, is seeing the people who have decided to really create, to really pick up their lives, to really enter the dialogue and not just be a participant in it, but a driver in where this whole thing is going. That to me is the exciting part.
It is definitely exciting. And, you know, I've reoriented my life along many of the principles that you've been sharing for years on your website. We had a choice between staying in a very nice home that I bought at the bottom of the last real estate bubble. And so I got a screaming deal on it and could have probably been there one more year and had the thing paid off, or I had an opportunity to get a nice piece of land with water and the opportunity to grow probably most of my own food and actually have a business around producing food for other folks. And even though I've got other fingers into like medical risk assessment and whatnot, I felt pretty compelled to make this lifestyle change. And it was good not only for looking down the road, but my family is outside more. My kids play with chickens and goats and sheep. And so back to your microbiome, like my kids are earlobe to toenail covered in dirt and chicken poo. Right. And, you know, I mean, they're going to have very healthy immune systems. So I've really made a move in that direction. And interestingly, what it's built beyond, I think some initial financial resiliency is both human capital and the capital of the soil and the resources around me, which I think is a really common theme that you talk about.
Absolutely. This one of the great disservices that Wall Street has done is convince people that capital means money and money is managed by Wall Street. But in fact, there's lots of forms of capital that matter a lot. And this is what Adam and my next book is about, titled Prosper with an exclamation point. And it's about taking a set of ideas that we've seen other people use and modifying them slightly to around this idea that there are multiple forms of capital out there and you can exchange within and across them. So if I have financial capital, that's great. But I choose to exchange that for living capital, right? So I can buy compost, I can install fruit trees, I can build a garden, I'm building my soils up, I'm planting pollinator species, loving plants all around. And so that's building up my living capital. The thing I love about that, Rob, is that not only am I surrounded by more beautiful things, by the way, flowers that go all times of the year and well-pruned trees, all this, it's very enjoyable, beautiful place to live, but I get to eat better. Mm-hmm. And I'm connected back to that cycle of things growing and my relationship to plants and the things that I eat and my relationship to the meat, because we raise meat birds every year and harvest them ourselves as a family. So that reconnection part, it feels really good. The deal is, though, if the future totally goes a different direction, I think, and it is techno-utopia forever, I still win, because this is a great way to live and it's very grounding and we have good immune systems and all of that. But if it goes pear-shaped, if the future goes a little weird, having these installed forms of capital around me make me much more resilient than the person who doesn't have them. And so to me, I don't see how I lose by becoming more fit, by eating better, by surrounding myself with living capital, as one example, by deepening my social capital as another example. Those things all, when I do those, they feel good in the moment and they make me and my family much more resilient for whatever might be coming next.
Right, right. I remember on your website, you mentioned last year that because of the big freeze that you folks experienced, you had no water for 10 weeks. And talk a little bit about dealing with that, and then relate your story about when you had a guy from LA come out and it see your austere living situation.
Yeah, so what happened was our well pump died.
Okay.
And it was January, and this was the year of the vortex, the so-called polar vortex in New England, which was not this winter, but the one prior. And so it was in January and the well goes out. And so we have a well company come out and we sort of point vaguely where our plat map for our property says the well should be. It was buried. So they had to get to it. So they had to bring equipment in. But the ground was so hard. It was so bulletproof. It had been like 0 degrees or below for 20 days straight. It was just phenomenally, like an exceptionally cold period. And the guy said, yeah, I can't dig because you're where your well is too close to where the underground utilities are. And when it's this frozen, we put the tip of the machine in and we start to pull up. We might pull up a big slab and actually wreck your utility. So we can't do that. I said, no, you don't understand. We don't have water. He said, yeah, I'm very sympathetic to that, but I can't dig right now. I said, no, hold on. I have money, right? And he's like, no, I can't do anything. So like, what? I can't get my well fixed? He's like, no, not till this thaws. Hey, no worries, right? But this was the year of the polar vortex. It turned out it didn't thaw enough for 10 weeks.
Wow.
So what did we do? Well, we had a bunch of 5-gallon high-density polypropylene water containers that I'd had stored up, and we started putting them to use. And we went over to a neighbor's house and filled up 5 gallons and discovered that we could have a family of five live for about 15 gallons a day is what we were living on. And that included showers and doing the dishes. And so this gentleman comes over and he's a good friend of mine, and he's spends a lot of time in LA, film editor, and he comes in one day, and there's my daughter and a friend of hers, and they're just in the kitchen, and they've got two tubs, and they've heated water on the stove, and they've poured hot water and soapy hot water into tub A, and tub B is the rinse water, and they're just happily just doing their chores, which is the dishes. And he just took one look, and he's like, what are they doing? I said, well, they're doing the dishes. He goes, but you have a dishwasher. Like, well, it doesn't work because we don't have water. He said, what do you mean? No water? Total emergency. He's like, wow, shouldn't you be like at a hotel somewhere? Like, nope, totally dealing with this. We had sun showers hung up in the showers, and my kids knew how to do dishes because we've been for 30 years. We've gone to a place in Maine where we spend a couple weeks every summer where there's no running water. It's just a cabin. There's no electricity and they're used to it. So for them, it was just like, you know, taking their summer experience and running it at home, and it wasn't a big deal. And it wasn't a big deal because we had the training and we'd had the situational knowledge of living without running water as part of our routine daily life. And so what I take from that is that if you have the right mental orientation and you've practiced things, then handling something that for somebody else would be a complete crisis wasn't even a blip on our radar screen. I mean, we loved getting our water back, but this wasn't a huge crisis. This was more of a minor inconvenience for us. And so that's really part of our message at Peak Prosperity is, you know, if you think the time to really begin to understand how to grow stuff or make better friendships or work on your health is when the crisis gets serious, we'll tell you that we think that's too late. It's suboptimal. What you really want to do is begin gathering the skills and that embodied knowledge. Because knowing stuff that you've read is one part of the story, but having the embodied experience of putting that in practice is the rest of the story. And so that's what we counsel people is like, get out there and just start getting your fingers dirty and practice these things, because you never quite know when or what's going to happen. But when something does happen, as the water experience taught my family, if you've had the prior training, it's really not a big deal. Mm-hmm. It's just something you deal with.
So how do the kids overall take to all this stuff? Like, are they just, you know, they're like, oh man, dad, this is so crazy. I can't wait to get out of the house and live a normal existence around normal people. Or how are they dealing with, you know, growing up in this little bit of a alternative track?
Well, we'll see how it all turns out. One's that the youngest is 15 and the next oldest is 17. So a little question mark. We'll see where they go with this. The 21-year-old is just absolutely bought into this whole thing and has decided that that her experience with her personal friend sets that she developed in the area and her experience with our family, that for her it's really important to be around people who are genuine and passionate about something. And so she really skinnied down her friend list from people she used to know, because what she cares about now is having authentic experiences that are real. And she does emotional processing and interpersonal work with people that blows me away. Stuff that I still don't understand. I've tried and I've learned a lot and I've made a lot of progress, but somehow she's just growing up differently. And so, you know, we get this question, people like, well, doesn't this sort of existential crisis you talk of, didn't that turn your kids into complete, zombies and unhappy individuals? The answer is no. They're really engaged, really bright, really shiny, very resilient, and I think really capable for what's coming next. But that's how we raised them. You know, Rob, we knew that this world was going to be changing. We knew that the Prussian model of educating children in the public school system was not ideal, because how many factories are there to mm-hmm. stuff people into? And so we were actually teaching towards a number of different adjectives than I think public schools normally do. We wanted our kids to be curious, engaged, fearless, creative. You know, those were the sorts of things we wanted. And of those, the most important, if I could counsel anybody, this is like the Hippocratic Oath of education. First, do not destroy a child's curiosity. Hmm. Because guess what? I have a phone. I can take any course I want. MIT has all their courses online. I have to be curious enough to want to do that, right? So if you just don't wreck somebody's curiosity, you win.
Right, right. The deal is pretty much done. Yeah, yeah. Chris, how did you get curious about it? Both you and Adam, I guess, really allocated some significant time and effort into your own personal wellness capital the last couple of years. Talk to folks a little bit about that.
Yeah, you know, Adam and I, slightly different stories, but both of us really wanted to become healthier. For me, there was a little crisis involved in it. I was, I'd always been reasonably healthy, and then starting about 2 years ago, I started to notice a number of things, which I just attributed to, I'm just getting old, right? This was just the part of my story. It was like, oh, I guess I'm getting old. But what was happening for me was I got a bursitis in my left shoulder, and it really cut down on my exercise routine. And then that became patellar tendon, you know, so I started doing a lot of hiking up and down a mountain, and all of a sudden I couldn't go down anymore. My patellar tendons were just screaming at me. And then I couldn't do push-ups anymore because my elbows were screaming at me and my energy was low. And so I'm a little bit stubborn around this stuff. I just kept trying to push through it all and it wasn't working. And so finally I went to a great functional medicine specialist, Dr. Aviva Workin. She's a naturopath, and much to my scientist delight, her first thing was, well, we're drawing 20 million vials of blood. We're going to start with a bunch of data. And so we got a bunch of blood work and just got some data. And the data said that I had leaky gut syndrome, and that my adrenals were a little shot, and I was kind of low on some things. Testosterone being one of the final things in that cascade. My B12 was so low, she said, how did you drive here? You should be asleep right now. And then there was an IgG immunoglobulin test for food sensitivities, and I just got this fingerprint of different food categories and specific foods that showed that my body was mounting a low-level war against a variety of foods, many of which were my favorites. And so what we did was started by modifying my diet, or my eating regime, I guess I should say, to just eliminate those things that I was fighting. And for me, my fingerprint, eggs were the worst. Almonds were not good. Scallops weren't good. A variety of things that even if I'd gone into a paleo cookbook, I would have been encountering. So for me, it was important information to know what I was specifically fighting, so I could exclude those. And I did that and took some supplements and a variety of things to boost my things that were sort of missing from my blood work that said they should be there, like B12. And took about 3 months, and I started to feel a big turnaround in this. And by 6 months into this story, I was able to, all the joint pains went away. And I'm about a year into that, a little past a year in my eating regime story, and pretty much everything's been fixed at this point. So all these things I thought, oh, I'm just getting old, was actually because I had leaky gut and I was fighting the foods I was eating, and it was just killing me slowly.
Well, I mean, that's kind of our meat and potatoes around here, talking about systemic inflammation, and you know, this is one of the anecdotal pieces, but compelling pieces for me about this kind of evolutionary medicine paleo diet story, that non-Westernized cultures tend to age very, very differently than we do. If they get past their 20s or 30s, they tend to live into advanced age and relatively free of Western degenerative diseases. And it seems to be that the sleep, the food, the exercise, the photo period, the gut microbiomes, and then also the socialization that these folks have all play really powerful vectors into whether or not, you know, the aging is graceful or a plane into a mountainside like most of us in Westernized societies experience. So that's really phenomenal. Say the name of your doc again.
Aviva Wortkin. She's out of Brattleboro, Vermont. Okay. And just phenomenal.
Fantastic. Well, Chris, you are bringing down property values by sharing a stage with me here pretty soon in Sebastopol, California.
Looking forward to it.
Happy feet jazz, like can't keep my feet on the ground, excited for this. Do you want to tell folks a little bit about that?
Yeah, I can't wait. September 2nd. This is in Sebastopol, and it has two components. I think first there's a meetup for hors d'oeuvres. There'll be hors d'oeuvres and cocktails. That's downtown Sebastopol. And I think that's from 5 to 6:30, if I remember the times right. And then at 7 o'clock, from 7 to 9, at the Grange. The Grange in Sebastopol is the main event. And so for both of those, people can buy tickets and come and engage. I think the hors d'oeuvres and cocktails, a little more meet and greet, a little more informal. And then you and Adam and I will be having we'll be doing a joint talk at the Grange there from 7 to 9. So $15 for that. And I think if you want to do the cocktails and hors d'oeuvres, it's $40 for that. And I can't wait to meet you and whoever else shows up.
Yeah, I'm very excited for that. I think sometimes the folks that follow the podcast, there's burgeoning interest in all this stuff. But I've got to say, I had talked so much about protein, carbs, fat, fitness, you know, all that type of stuff when I started weaving in this story about like, hey, you know, it, regardless of how you want to eat, whether it's paleo or vegan or what have you, you know, this sustainability story is really important. And the immediate extension from that sustainability story was energy, the economy, and the environment. And so when I was turned on to your work from actually Chris Kresser, it was just an incredible light bulb moment for me. And I've been just a huge fan, huge follower, and it's going to be a fantastic honor hanging out with you guys. I will have links to all the information on the event. Folks can go to peakprosperity.com to purchase those tickets. And I'm very excited for this.
Absolutely. And people can purchase tickets at the door if it's not sold out. They can take that chance or just come to the site. But yeah, it's going to be a great event. And I really think these two areas just really belong together, because I really think that what Adam and I do is just provide a little more context for why people should really do this. You know, sort of like I want to be in shape. I'm like, maybe you need to be in shape. You know, So there's a little, both of those pieces can come together, provide another angle of saying, oh, this is important. Let me get serious now.
Well, and you know, the cool thing too is that you guys have created a phenomenal community where you get that other piece. So we can learn about all this stuff, think about it, take some action in our day-to-day lives. But then we're starting to meet people within these communities where we get that human capital part of the story as well, which is really the only glue that I think will cement it all together and make this stuff stick and make it work over the long haul.
I agree. So yeah, we'll keep applying some of that glue at this event.
Awesome. Well, Chris, when is the prospective date for Prosperity? When do you think we might see that?
Prosperity?
Is that the name of the new book coming out?
Oh, Prosper. Prosper. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Prosper. I was like, yeah, when are we going to see prosperity? Well, I'm kind of living, I'm surrounded by it. I don't know about everybody else, but it's here. But Prosper, the book, is the manuscript's at the publishers, and we're looking for a mid-October launch for that. So we're going to hit the holiday cycles on this, and right. And that's when it's all going to come out. And it's going to be in Spanish. It's going to be in English. We're going to do a book on tape audiobook as part of this too. So we're really hitting this one much differently than the last one.
Great. Well, let's get you back on the show when that is in its release queue, and let's try to get a New York Times bestseller out of this and get this out to a lot of folks.
Fantastic. Looking forward to it.
Awesome, Chris. Well, again, huge honor. I don't want to be overly gushing here, but you've been a huge influence in both my life and the life of my family. Huge positive benefit, and very much looking forward to the talk in Sebastopol coming up on September 2nd.
Well, thank you for all of that. Thank you for the work you do, and likewise, huge fan of what you're doing. So, can't wait to finally meet you in person.
Looking forward to it. Enjoy your time in Maine, and I'll talk to you soon.
Fantastic. Thank you.
All right, Chris, take care.